from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT. Today, our Strategic Risk Assessment Talk will discuss something kind of close to home, the rather dramatic events that are burbling up in Cuba. And you've probably seen stuff on the news, but we're going to talk about that communist island's future in the near term and longer term, its relationship with the U.S., but also the implications this has for the Western Hemisphere and certainly the U.S. position in the Western Hemisphere. So let me just kind of hit you with what's going on right up front. The U.S., the United States is taking steps to indict Raul Castro, the 94-year-old former president of Cuba and the brother of Fidel Castro, you know, basically the Castro brothers ruling over Cuba. And I would argue still Raul still does call the shots in Cuba since 1959. And this is in connection to something I vividly recall, which was their downing of of U.S. planes 30 years ago. And so U.S. officials are talking about this. They're not so much being named, but it is pretty clear that this is happening, and it is a point of discussion in the U.S.-Cuba relationship. Now, this potential indictment, which would obviously need to be approved by a grand jury, and there has been some speculation out there, would a grand jury actually do this? Is expected to focus on this 1996 shooting of these planes. It was a humanitarian group called Brothers to the Rescue, and the incident dates back to February 1996 when two Cessnas that they were flying were basically brought down. And it was brought down by a Cuban MiG-29 fighter jet, and it killed four people. So it's rather an interesting thing to kind of point out. Of all the things that Raul Castro has done over the years, this one is kind of interesting that they point to this. A report by the Organization of American States found that the planes were shot down outside of Cuban airspace, and that is a problem, legally speaking, for Cuba, and alleged that Cuba violated international law by shooting them down without warning and without evidence that it was necessary to do so. And I'm sure someone out there is going to say, well, what are we doing with these narco terror or these boats in the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific? And I'm sure someone will bring that up at some point, but that is separate apart from this particular issue, the way it is laid out there. Now, it drew a lot of outrage at the time. In fact, then President Bill Clinton condemned it in what could only be called the strongest possible terms. The plan comes together on this as the U.S. is putting tremendous pressure on the Cuban government as a whole. Now, just for reference, in case anybody has forgotten, Cuba is a big island south of the United States in the Caribbean, has a population of just under 11 million people. It's about 41,000 square miles, and at its closest point is only 90 miles from Florida. And some major events, obviously, 1959 was a Cuban Revolution that brought in Fidel Castro and his brother Raul into power. And then there was a Bay of Pigs invasion that happened shortly after President Kennedy had come into office in 1961 that went very, very badly. And that obviously changed things. The Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, the Missiles of October, as they like to say, which put a whole strategic context on what Cuba was doing down there, because there were Soviet missiles, nuclear weapons that were being put on Cuban soil. And then there was waves of mass migration that took place across Cuba in the 80s and 90s and afterwards, of Cubans desperate trying to get away from Cuba, essentially, and trying to make their way to the U.S. Now, the U.S. administration has threatened heavy tariffs, not just punitive things on Cuba, but they've actually heavy tariffs on any country that exports oil to Cuba. As you may recall, the U.S. went in there last December and took out, seized President Maduro from Venezuela, took him out of the country. He's presently getting ready to stand trial in New York City, rather pretty big deal because he was technically the head of state for Venezuela, but he was protected by Cuban security personnel as well. And Venezuela was really the oil lifeline for Cuba. It was what's keeping them afloat in terms of energy. And that got cut off. And Mexico was kind of starting to fill that bill. The U.S. put tremendous pressure on Mexico. All of a sudden, Mexico made a decision to no longer provide oil to Cuba. And Russia provided a short lifeline of oil that came in with a tanker, but that apparently had been got used up really quick. And so Cuba is out of oil, and it's out of energy, and it's out of power, and the lights are off for the most part. So Trump administration threatening heavy tariffs on the country, supporting them to deal with that energy shortage, has pretty much cut off Cuba from oil, which has cut off Cuba from having power across the country. President Trump has also talked about the need for major reforms. He talked about maybe a, quote, friendly takeover of Cuba at one point, which is kind of interesting. So all this stuff is kind of going on in the background, and it's a real question as to what we're actually seeing as Cuba's end state. But definitely we want to see the regime change, the current regime. Now, Raul Castro, just for reference, stepped down as the leader of Cuba's Communist Party in 2021, but he's still widely seen as the most powerful figure within the country. His grandson, Raul Guillermo Rodriguez Castro, often known as Raulito, all right, little Raul, is viewed as both a representative of Raul Castro and a key point of contact with the U.S. and Cuba, and actually has kind of is more important than the president right now in terms of, in many ways, U.S.-Cuba dialogue. The pressure on Cuba to pick up began to really pick up in January. The U.S. military removed Nicolas Maduro from power and then flew him to New York. And Venezuela was a key partner of Cuba going back decades. And certainly, if you go back to the Maduro regime and before, when all that was taking place, they were basically a huge part of what kept Cuba going and also enabled Cuba to export, you know, left-wing communist stuff around the South America and Central America, and also allowed it to interface with other countries like Nicaragua and stuff like that. Even though there was direct back and forth, it basically empowered Cuba to do a lot of things that they have been doing. Now, CIA Director John Ratcliffe met with Raulito, the younger Castro, this last week, Thursday, following an earlier visit that he had with him last month. And Ratcliffe basically delivered President Trump's message that the U.S. is prepared to seriously engage with Cuba on economic and security issues, but only if Cuba makes some very fundamental changes. In fact, the CIA official stated afterwards that Cuba can no longer be a safe haven for adversaries in the Western Hemisphere. And that reaches across a number of different things, obviously, not the least of which is the things that Cuba is doing to enable Chinese and Russian activities in the Western Hemisphere as well. So what does this all mean to the U.S.? Well, first off, within Cuba itself, the lights are out. People are running around at night in the dark, banging on pans and stuff in frustration because there's no power. I think power's out like 22 hours a day there, which means it's very difficult to do basic things like cook food and things like that. So that is a huge, huge problem for Cuba. And basically, rather than a military intervention, what you're seeing is a supply chain intervention, which is just making it impossible for Cuba to function as a nation state, as an economic unit, if you will, across the board. So it's a rather interesting way of doing this. And it's not a full-on naval blockade. Certainly, we saw that in 1962 with the Missiles of October. That was our strategy then. But this has basically cut off energy and power to Cuba, which has basically strangled their economy. And their economy was doing very badly before that. And if you look at some of the things, well, I think the most telling thing with Cuba was they had a series of hurricanes go across Cuba. And every time the hurricanes came back or came through, they were hitting areas that had not recovered from the previous hurricane. And that was a measure of the government's ability to respond and recover from these things. And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And this was not going unnoticed by the Cuban people. And so a lot of frustration in Cuba. In fact, the man on the street stuff in Cuba is very anti-regime, which is really a shift from where it was some years back. So big change in what's going on there. What does this mean strategically to the U.S. and the Western Hemisphere? It means a vast, sudden diminishment of Russian and Chinese influence in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, that was their, basically, Cuba was the big outpost. For certainly for Russia, it was always the big outpost that they could use for a variety of different things. China kind of riding on the coattails of Russia in that regard, that they could do things in Cuba that they couldn't do elsewhere in Latin America. And so that's one of those things that they were able to do across the board, was to operate in the security sphere more directly as that was going on. Now, if you look at Bolivia, the political landscape has changed dramatically there in very recently. If you look at the election of Rodrigo Paz, a pro-business conservative, took office November 8th of last year, 2025. His administration really signals a big departure from nearly two decades of essentially socialist rule under Evo Morales, during which time Bolivia really had distanced itself from the United States and really strengthened its ties with countries like China and Russia. Now that has shifted. He has expressed a real commitment to restoring diplomatic relations with the U.S. fully, which has been very strained since 2008 when the U.S. ambassador was essentially expelled from Bolivia. So that was a big deal. Mexico never really parted ways with the U.S. per se, but certainly there's been some very strained relationships with them. A lot of frustration with Mexico's inability to basically curtail the cartels. That has shifted. Mexico is very, very much going after the cartels. This is obviously for the president of Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum. This has caused some tremendous political pressure for her in terms of dealing with this. Certainly the U.S. assessment has always been that, or has been certainly of late, that the cartel's influence goes very high up within the Mexican government. And that's been true for a very, very long time. I worked extensively in the war on drugs back in the 90s. That was a problem back then. And so that's a big issue. Now, there's been reports recently that CIA operatives are running not freely throughout the country, but working with a very, I would say, smaller group of Mexico security forces, very close-in activities. And the fact that two operatives were killed in an actual attack recently, the news of that put some strain on certainly the president of Mexico and her government, that why do you have CIA operatives doing this? Well, I would point out that there were CIA, or not CIA, but there were intelligence operations looking at the cartels for quite some time. I'd seen reports many months ago that we were flying drones and other aircraft over Mexico looking for the cartels. And we've always been very involved with Mexico and working with the counter-cartel stuff, but much more so now. And certainly with Mexico's decision to cut off oil to Cuba, that was, to me, very telling of where the relationship with Mexico is going. And you may recall that President Trump had actually threatened to do military operations in Mexico, which, of course, Mexico complained about, that was a violation of its sovereignty, which it would have been a violation of its sovereignty. But they have very quietly, behind the scenes, done a lot of other things to kind of to deal with this in other ways. And I would mention that when you talk about that, what was reported was it was the CIA's, I think, ground operations thing, which sounds a lot like its old Special Activities Division, which if you go back way back when was their paramilitary branch. That's a way of getting that sort of expertise, that kind of capability into Mexico, going after cartels, which would be just short of putting uniformed special operations forces down there. All right. Now, I was involved at the beginnings of the discussions of a thing that became Operation Casablanca, which I actually was looking at a different country, not Mexico, but that in the time since I left that particular multi-jurisdictional task force, they turned it into a Mexico operation. This was back in the 90s. And so this was a very big deal that they had put together. But that was where it went up to a certain point. And back then, if you go back 30 years, it got shut down because it got so high up within the Mexican government. We are no longer reticent to go that high up in the Mexican government and point out these things like we were back then. Then it was politically embarrassing. We didn't want to do it. And so the whole thing got shut down, or at least that's what was reported. But I don't think that would be a problem now. Nicaragua is also under Daniel Ortega and the communists down in Nicaragua. That has always been another country that we've had a difficult relationship with. Daniel Ortega is old, and his power seems to be somewhat waning in that regard. But certainly without Cuba there, it makes very difficult for Nicaragua to really refuse or to be defiant of the United States, because it's surrounded by close U.S. allies in Central America. There is no Cuba out there. There is no Venezuela out there. And certainly, I think something that every country in the world that has aligned itself with Russia and China has seen, they're really not there when they get into troubles. So I think that's going to shift dramatically. And I think it is starting to shift dramatically. The U.S. has initiated a number of things. Something that didn't get as much attention, but it was tied to something else it did, was the America Counter-Cartel Coalition, about 17 different countries under primary leadership of the U.S. Department of War, really going after the cartels in a major way. And you certainly see Operation Southern Spear, where basically we're striking drug boats and semi-submersibles and stuff on a pretty regular basis. Almost 200, quote, narco-terrorists, as we define narco-terrorists, have been killed, and over 50 strikes throughout the area. Now, the U.S. began counter-cartel operations with U.S. military in Ecuador. I think this is a significant operation. I think it's been largely overlooked because of all the other things happening in the world, places like Iran. But it just goes to show how things are dramatically changing. And without Cuba being that pro-Russian, pro-Chinese outpost of legacy communism in the Western Hemisphere, it could really shift everything. I think you see a different U.S. position coming out of this in a very, very major way. So this could be a massive shift in Western hemispheric relations. It could be something that changes the way, I think it's going to change things as dramatically as things changed, certainly in 1959 when Fidel Castro came to power. And one could argue this is kind of a restoration of the U.S. having a very dominant role on this entire side of the planet, which I think is President Trump's goal. And certainly if you look at natural resources, you look at minerals, you look at oil, you look at everything, strategically speaking, this is a very important thing for the United States and much needed. Thanks for listening to Strap. Also, please go to strappodcast.com. You can go to my YouTube channel, Hal Kempfer TV, or go to the GRIP Global Risk Intelligence and Planning website, which is www.gripsa.com. And also coming up in June, you will see that there's if you go to Los Angeles InfraGuard website, I'm doing another global threat update webinar. Hopefully you can register for that and spend some quality time and actually get to ask me some questions online about various things, basically taking an entire trip around the planet. So anyway, thanks again, and hope you tune in for the next one.